From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Working as a freelancer offers enormous opportunity as well as anxiety. It's not enough to be great at what you do. You have to be equally good at convincing other people you're great at what you do. The challenges of working independently are many, which is why Sarah Horowitz, the founder of the Freelancers Union, wrote her new book, The Freelancer's Bible. It's chock full of tips on how to market your services, price your product, even obtain health care. We'll talk with Sarah Horowitz about being a freelancer next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. If you've ever worked as a freelancer, you know this feeling, a curious mixture of freedom and dread that comes when you work for yourself. You're so glad you're out there on your own, but you don't know what's going to happen next. It's kind of like driving down a lovely stretch of highway when your tank is bumping on empty. Millions of Americans now work independently, but independence and a paycheck don't always go hand in hand. Indeed, according to a 2011 survey from the Freelancers Union, only 80% of freelancers say they had enough work in the previous year. So it's great to be your own boss, except when things aren't going well and the only place you have to look is the mirror. Sarah Horowitz's new book, The Freelancer's Bible, provides plenty of tips on how to navigate the opportunities and anxieties of this freelance world. She's the founder of Freelancers Union and joins us this morning from New York as we consider how to thrive, not just survive, as a freelancer. Sarah, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you with us on our program. So the new unemployment numbers came out this morning, 150,000 plus new jobs created, unemployment staying the same at 7.8%. So we're kind of bumping along in this place where we've been for some time now. Why does freelancing make sense in the economy as we currently are experiencing it?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that when we are tracking these 150,000 jobs, they are full-time jobs, W-2 employment. We don't really actually have good numbers for how freelancers are working. And the best numbers that we have is that it's actually now a third of the workforce, 42 million Americans. So I wrote the Freelancer's Bible because I wanted to start saying to people, we don't all have to reinvent the wheel. We can figure out what are the tried and true things that freelancers have done in the past. And to your point, it can actually be such a great way of living, not just working.
On the question of how many people are doing it, it's sort of hard sometimes to parse through the numbers. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has something like 9 million people as independent workers, freelancers. When you get to that larger number that you described, are you grouping together people who run their own businesses? How do you come up with the figure that a third of all workers are independent?
Yeah, so basically independence just means that you're not working for one company full-time as a W-2 employee. So it's everybody's from temp to part-timers, solo entrepreneurs, self-employed, consultants, freelancers. And when you add up all those, it's a third of the workforce. But interestingly, when we do the jobs numbers, it tends to really be the full-timers and the part-timers, not the people who are really piecing together their careers, which is what is really becoming the dominant trend of work right now.
So if you're thinking about going freelance, what are some of the first questions one ought to ask oneself? Is it a question of sort of who you are and what it is you want to do? Is it a question of the specific skills that you have? Give us sort of the checklist that someone contemplating going independent ought to first begin to consider.
Well, I think, you know, the funny thing is you could kind of divide people into two categories. There are the people who are like, you know what, this is the kind of work I want. I want to work on my own. I've always been like this. And then there are the other people for whom the economy is changing so much that freelancing is the way that they're going to work. So whichever way you get there, the checklist really has to be assessing, you know, what are you good at? What do you want to be doing? And realizing that you actually have this freedom to be thinking about your whole self. So you want to start saying, what are the areas that I want to work as a freelancer that I know that I can pick up actual work right away? what are some areas that I want to be moving into? And then I think the third is really an economic calculation. When rubber hits the road, you're just starting out. Where are you going to get that money that's going to pay your rent or mortgage or car? And what are you going to do to sort of cut back on maybe your consumption in the beginning just to make sure you're okay? And then to start planning from there.
So let's say I'm a newspaper reporter and I sort of see the handwriting on the wall that this is not exactly a growth industry. And so I want to sort of go out. I can write. I have a lot of good experience. But I'm nervous about how to go about this. How do I go about this?
You know, I'd say one thing in talking to freelancers, for sure, and this just might seem so strange as the first thing you talk about, you have to get a network of people. And that doesn't mean you pull out your business card to shove into somebody's face. It's really, I think, about love and the people that you want to be connected to. So here you are, you're a freelance journalist. Why don't you think about the people that you know that you like who are already freelance journalists? And not a million people, two, three. Then you might want to think, who are the people I know who are seasoned freelancers? Let me talk to them. Then you might want to just start to realize that this is how you find out how much to charge. What should I do in a dry spell? Who do I meet for lunch when I'm so tired of working in my own house, in my jammies? And actually what you find is that this network that you put together is the way that you will find work, get work done, have life balance. And it's so much more important for freelancers than it is for people who are just working traditional jobs.
So if I'm not someone who likes the word network or feels uncomfortable in that arena, who's more of a loner, let's say, is that someone then almost by definition who really is not a good candidate to make it as a freelancer?
You know, it's funny. In writing the Freelancer's Bible, I think the most important thing that you realize is, like, we're all human and we all need to be connected to people. It really doesn't matter if you're shy or an introvert. You can find your way to be connected. No one can exist in an isolated form, whether you're freelancing or not freelancing. And so on the question of are there certain personalities who lend themselves, I think what you realize, as you pointed out in the intro, is you have to do the work. You have to market yourself to get the work. Once you get the work, you have to become your own benefits and tax specialist. Repeat. And you're not. No one's going to be able to know that. And so you want to start finding, you know, resources like the Freelancer's Bible, your friends who is the best person at doing taxes, and starting to really kind of compensate for your strengths and your weaknesses and realizing, again, to the point of the network, how do you have a give and take? I'll give you another example. So you've crossed the path. You've decided to be a freelancer. The first thing you learn is the income is episodic. You know, you have too much work sometimes, feast, no work, famine. The most seasoned freelancers learn that they have people who they exchange and barter and outsource work to. So I think that's really important to do. You have to get the client the best work, but you need to guarantee that, but it might be that someone does a piece of that work for you. By the same token, when you're in a drought, you got to have some people to call to say, you know what, you have anything that I can do. And again, that's how you're piecing this together.
Sarah Horowitz joins us. She is the founder of Freelancers Union and the author of a new guide to living the freelance life called The Freelancer's Bible. We welcome your calls and participation in our hour today. If you're a freelancer, have questions for Sarah, if you're struggling with something that you have a question about, we'd love to hear from you. If you have ideas and tips you want to offer up for other freelancers, we'd love to get that as well. 866-733-6786 is our number, 866-733-6786. Email us at form@kqed.org or post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page or on our website. What about our old friend anxiety? You know, you mentioned the dry spells and the ups and downs, but sometimes I feel like it is a bit like, you know, riding a roller coaster without a safety bar, without a seatbelt, and that you're always anxious. You're always worried that next call won't come. How do you kind of cool that out?
Right. You know, you're so right. So I think the first thing to almost any kind of anxiety is, you know, after you've taken that deep breath, then you realize this happens to everybody, whether you are the most seasoned and best and most skilled. And so calm, it's going to, you're going to get out of it. And really, that is important. Then you start to really need to have different short and long-term strategies. So the long-term strategy is to start looking at your field. As you pointed out, there are certain fields that are just evolving. Some freelancers who are graphic artists, they talk about how they market themselves as graphic artists and then as brand specialists. So it's a moment to take the time to say, is there another way, another field I can kind of segue into? Is this the time for some R&D for me to maybe start learning new things? And also assessing, am I spending enough time getting my tried and true work that's going to come in month after month, whether that's a temp job, whether that's a freelance gig that's just basic? And you have to start having that long-term horizon so that when you have that moment of panic, you say, you know what, I have a plan. This is what I'm going to be doing about it.
So is it, if you're freelancing, is it good to be, on the one hand, it seems to me it's good to be really versatile, able to do lots of different things. On the other, and you write about this some in your book, it's really useful to have a specialty. I remember once when my daughter was applying to college, we went to Middlebury College in Vermont, and I always remember the admissions director saying, you know, we don't really want well-rounded students. We want a well-rounded student body. We want a collection of individuals who each have a specialty. So my advice to you is to learn how to play the piccolo, because every college needs a piccolo player. So does that apply? Do you know what I mean? That you need to have something special, like playing the piccolo, that sets you apart as unique? Or is it better to be kind of all-purpose and well-rounded?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is a self-assessment. You know, if you're just never going to be that piccolo player, don't try, right? And so you want to look at, do you have a, you know, your special sauce and what is that? But you know what I think is really amazing about freelancers is that there's an opportunity here. You might say, you know what, I'm going to be an accountant because that pays the rent, but opera singing actually really matters to me, or taking 2 hours out of my day and doing something that nobody else, you know, would think is normal. And putting that into your day and managing that. And I think that's the kind of thing that you want to assess and keep growing. And that's what I think, why I think freelancers are so important to our whole economy, because what they're starting to do is to say, let me reassess my life here. If I'm going to be working on projects and gigs, then I get to really put things together in a way that I didn't when I was a full-time employee.
Let's hear from some of our listeners this morning who are in the business of freelancing or would like to, have questions, concerns, thoughts, and ideas. Ivan joins us first from Marin. Ivan, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a freelancer. I am a freelance copywriter and have been for just over 32 years. And I would say this, I get many questions from people saying, you know, what should I do? You know, how do I get started in freelancing? Is freelancing right for me? And I think it really, you have to ask yourself this one crucial question. Do you enjoy selling and marketing? You can be an expert in any field, but if you don't get up in the morning and really enjoy the idea of how you're going to market yourself and throw yourself into it with gusto, I think you're a non-starter. I'm curious to know what your guest thinks.
I agree with you, but before I chime in, I'll let Sarah go ahead.
Great.
Well, you know, I think that we're all going to agree that marketing, for sure, you must have. If you don't bring the work in, it all doesn't really matter. I think the question is, what exactly is marketing? And I think that some people can be really put off by that because it feels like you're sitting at home and making cold calls. And really, when you freelance or almost do any kind of work, the thing you realize is that you start getting business by word of mouth, and that really helps grow your business, and that can end up feeling actually a lot more interesting. So to the point of network, it's about, you know, again, taking advantage of the tax code, go and have lunch with prospective people who might hire you. It is a tax break. Start to build your network. Go and find those people who can help you and send work your way. That will feel a lot more doable, I think, than to say you must know how to market yourself, because I think that conjures up a scary image. I don't know, Ivan, what do you think of that?
Well, I also think, sorry. If I can just jump in with that thought, is that one of the key words I think you just said, Sarah, is the word go. Go and have lunch. You have to be willing to go. You have to be willing to ask, right? You can't be someone who is unwilling to put yourself out there.
Yeah, you have to. Part of marketing is going out and having lunch with people, but you have to enjoy it. You have to enjoy the interpersonal and the selling and negotiation aspect of it. Also, in the world now that we live in the world of the internet, you know, creating a list, sending out blogging, sending out a newsletter. Being constantly involved in marketing yourself, I think, in an online environment is extremely important. And just for me, and this is just my opinion, just networking, it's got limited value. I publish an online newsletter with 5,000 readers, and I've built over time, and I found it to be a tremendous success and moneymaker. And I would, again, let me just reiterate, if you don't really enjoy marketing, forget about it.
Ivan, thanks. Thanks for getting us started with our calls and ideas from freelancers all around the Bay Area and around the country this morning. Chris Cullen is joining us next. He's a freelance writer who is the author of What Really Happened to the Class of 93, frequent contributor to Salon and the New York Times as well. Chris, thanks for joining in on our program. What do you think of what Ivan just said in terms of this question of you got to be able to market, even someone like you who's had lots of success and contributing writing to publications like the New York Times. Is that true for you, that you've got to be able to keep putting yourself out there?
It's not something that has been a part of my life, I don't think, unless there's a definition of marketing that I'm just sort of overlooking. I think whatever works, it obviously, is what works. I'm certainly not opposed to marketing. I find that my intelligence and bandwidth is so limited that I can only do about two semi-competent things a day anyway. So that just doesn't happen to be one of them. I mean, for me, the thing that is important is just making sure you're interested in what you're doing. I mean, the reason you become a writer, in theory, is because you are interested in stuff and you want to learn more about it and then talk about it.
So, Chris, if the New York Times called you and said, you know, we'd like you to be our Bay Area, full-time correspondent, would you want that? Does that appeal to you? Or is the price of sort of being bound to a single organization greater than the freedom appeal that you have as an independent?
I think that's a question a lot of writers are always struggling with. Whenever there's an opportunity to come in from the cold, it's always tempting, of course. But in those moments, I always sort of go over the numbers, and I realize I have not starved yet in my, 13 years of being a writer. You always think you're about to starve. But in truth, I mean, in my experience, the work is there. What I was going to say before, if you can just, be interested, that becomes a kind of marketing, I think. Basically, the world is just sort of a bar that you're telling a story to on a Friday night. That is a kind of marketing, I guess. I mean, you're just sort of trying to get people interested in the story that you're interested in, and I think that leads to more assignments. For me, the big issue is knowing whether you're doing something for love or money. I think that can be a trap. If you aren't clear about an assignment from the beginning, you can sort of drift into some unholy middle ground where you're doing work that you sort of love and it's sort of for decent money, but really not enough of either.
And would you say, Sarah, that the part of what Chris is saying is that you need to kind of trust your own talent and that if you build it, people will come?
Well, I think that Chris is making a great point about love or money and being clear, because you can actually be pretty strategic about it and say, this amount of money actually has to come in the door to pay the things that need to get paid. But it also really matters, A, that you love what you do, but also that you take some part of your week or your day and do the things that you love. And I think what is also really important is that freelancing really goes across the economic spectrum, across fields, people in finance and health, the arts, writers, and that there are certain fields now where whether you like it or not, this really is the way it's going to be. IBM predicts that half its workforce are going to be working like this, engineers, people in the sciences. And so, you know, the idea of you have to just go, I think really is the point. And whether you like it or you don't like it, freelancers kind of have to be a bit thrifty. They have to be a little bit DIY. And while that can be annoying or hard or uncomfortable in the beginning, I think it actually makes for a much more independent and interesting person.
Chris, thanks for adding your perspective on this question. Let's hear from another freelancer. Kaya in Berkeley joins us next. Kaya, go ahead.
Hi. I'm a self-employed yoga teacher, and I just wanted to say that over the years I figured out that there are certain things that I could choose to do myself outside the realm of the actual teaching. You know, to grow my business, and other things that I made a clear choice to pay other people to do. So, for example, I pay a CPA their full rate. I don't really do trade. I have found that that gets a little confusing to compare the value of different fields. So I pay a CPA to do my taxes, but when I looked at paying somebody to build my website and update it every month, I found that it was more economical to just pay someone to teach me how to do that myself, so that I maintain my own website. But I pay people to do things like my taxes, or when I needed to paint my studio, I decided that it wasn't worth injuring my body or being achy the day after and not being able to work. So I'd rather pay somebody to do something like painting the studio for me.
Kaya, really interesting point, and Sarah, weigh in on this as well. It's not only an assessment of your strengths, but also sort of what makes sense, right? What makes sense in each individual case might be paying to do this, but doing something else yourself. You really have to inventory all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Kaya, you should be like the poster child of freelancing, because I think that, first of all, I completely agree. It's sort of one of these strange bits of advice that I think that people who freelance should hire accountants. You know, you'll just end up doing better. But I love the way you're evaluating and looking. And, you know, that really is, and again, to the point of having a network, you know, perhaps Kaya has a question about what would you do? What do you think? And when you have other people to bounce ideas off of, it makes you, A, feel connected, but it also is a source of a lot of different diversity of opinions.
Kaya, thanks so much for adding your 2 cents on this. Let's get in one more call before we go to a break. Ben, give us your thoughts real quickly, please. Ben, are you with us?
Yeah, go ahead. I am. I'm a video producer in Half Moon Bay, and my question is really around those of us who are 30s, 40s, who are now competing with the generation behind us. And this has come up quite a bit in a field that's rapidly evolving. Technology is changing very quickly. The barriers to entry for the industry are very, very low. So it's an interesting opportunity on the one hand, where there's a lot of demand, but there's also quite a bit of supply. There's a lot of freelancers running around, you know, competing and fighting for the same business. I'm curious if your guest has any insight.
Yeah, it's a terrific question, Ben. And Sarah, just give us a quick thought on that, and then we're going to go to a break, and we'll come back and pursue it more.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest issues is how do you price something, and how do you put that pricing in? Do you charge in the beginning, the end, the middle? It's a really complicated thing. Try to sort of get at that in the Freelancer's Bible to give you some tips.
We'll come back and talk more about that, about how you adjust with an ever-changing world, how you compete with those who are younger and know the latest technology, how you go about pricing your work, how you go about marketing it. We'll take up all of it when we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, how to survive as an independent worker, as a freelancer. Our guest, Sarah Horowitz, the founder of Freelancers Union and the author of a new guide to living the freelance life called The Freelancer's Bible. We welcome your calls, comments, suggestions, ideas, tips at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Before the break, Ben in Half Moon Bay was bringing us to this point of whether or not this is sort of a young person's game, Sarah Horowitz. I'm curious about your point of view on this. Paul Ankur, our engineer, we were chatting during the break, and he was saying, you know, how do you compete with people who are willing to live on ramen noodles? So what's your thought on that?
Well, you know, and people also say it's the same issue for competing internationally, that a lot of the new sites are auction sites where it's a race to the bottom, and you have to be careful about that. And, you know, there are a number of different strategies that people can try, and too many probably to go into here, but just a few would be to really talk about what the value that you're bringing to the table. You know, mm-hmm. one of the most important things when somebody is seasoned is they can deliver on time. They can troubleshoot. They know how to multitask. They know how to deal with something when there's a problem. That's all part of the price. And that's what quality people are getting. A number of people often raise different kinds of strategies about how you charge and that sort of thing, and I've tried to put a few of those into the freelancer's Bible.
And you have to be – that's also something I think that's important, and maybe something that applies in your situation too, Ben, is to have the confidence to say I'm worth this because I can do a certain amount. I know for me, as someone who works in a freelance capacity, I struggle with that. I'm willing to often say, yeah, I'll do that for $1.95. I mean, Sarah, you really – you have to be able to have a kind of confidence about what your experience and seasoning brings, yeah?
Yeah, you know, I think for sure it's your confidence, but I think you have to know your bottom line. And I think that mm-hmm. that is something that's so important. And your bottom line just simply is, you know, how much are you paying in rent or mortgage? You know, what are your expenses? And how are you making that happen? And that is where if it's going to make you keep working for 50% of your rate, that's just not going to be sustainable for you. But that's where I think you also have to be nimble. And, you know, talking about video production, I mean, media is changing just so fast. Again, it's that question of where's the R&D time? Where are you looking to the future? Where are you figuring out what you need to be picking up? Are there other areas you want to start going into?
Ben, thanks so much for bringing that question and concern. Bruce Crisp is on the line with us as well. He is a freelance trombonist. And Bruce, you've been at your work and surviving as a freelance musician for some time, and you have a somewhat different take on this, that time in the work that you do is an advantage as opposed to sort of not one, and that you having experience is useful as opposed to just being a newbie.
Oh, yes, for sure. Having experience is paramount when you're playing with an orchestra.
And what is it that's challenging to you about having to work with lots of different orchestras? Because as I understand it, you don't work with just one. You've got to sort of be on the circuit, yeah?
Right. Well, I work with many that I have contracts with that I've won auditions in, and then I also work with many that I don't have contracts with, and it means a lot of driving. It means a very complicated schedule that you have to try and piece together to make it work. And then you have to turn down work because you have other work, and that's just the way freelancing is, I guess.
And if the San Francisco Symphony offered you a full-time trombonist position, would you take that?
Yes, I would.
And because of the constancy that would bring, along with healthcare, I suspect, right?
Oh, yeah. Constancy, my pay would go up exponentially. I would get health care. They have all kinds of other benefits, like 10 weeks paid vacation. I don't get any paid vacation now. So, you know, that would be great, yeah. And also, it's a first-class orchestra, so playing with that level of player would be fantastic.
Yeah. I raised the question in part also, Sarah Horowitz, because sometimes I think, you know, it's important to remember that freelancing is sometimes not necessarily everyone's first choice. You do it because it's what you have to do to get by, but that dream of the job that will give you everything you want, both in a career you love but and constant income and health care. So, I mean, that's fair to say, right? Freelancing isn't always the goal. An opportunity that a full-time job might provide.
You know, I just would, as I was listening to Bruce, I was thinking, you know, let's just be clear. These jobs are great unionized jobs. Those orchestras have those jobs because that group has some collective bargaining model. And that's really important. And in the country, we're seeing the decline of unionism, which is the decline of the middle class. And I think that if there's one point I'd really want your listeners to get is that the nature of work is profoundly changing. To keep thinking that we have this choice is just not a truth anymore. The world is evolving. It's as big a revolution as when people left the family farms in the 1860s to work in the factories. And if we had a radio show then where we said, well, isn't it better to be back at the farm? Yeah, you know what? It probably was in a lot of ways. But that's just not the truth anymore. And I think that it's really important for people to understand that, that when they're graduating from college, they're likely going to freelance. Hmm. If they've been laid off, they're going to be freelancing. And it has wonderful qualities. There are definitely difficulties. And I don't in any way want to say that there aren't. But this is the reality.
So those protected union-type positions that are available are right now are in diminishing number? That's not the future anyone should imagine?
Well, you know, I hope, and, you know, when you look at Canada and Germany, you know, there's still a significant level of unionism. But in the private sector, it's really been a challenge. And that in and of itself, you know, is a concern. But unionism needs to evolve and freelancers need to come together, which is what the Freelancers Union does. We have over 200,000 members and people can join. It's free online and just go to freelancersunion.org. But it really is about this next economic moment that we're in and starting to build our own security. So with the Freelancers Bible, what I've tried to do is to hear what freelancers have told me over the years to put this so that people can help themselves individually. But ultimately, we need to come together and start talking about how do we start building back some security for people.
Bruce Crisp, thanks for adding your point of view to this. One of the questions that often comes up in terms of security people is this question of health care. What do you say to people about that, about how you can obtain and feel secure about providing health care for your family if you're in the freelance world?
Well, I think that is, you know, truly one of the most difficult things. And so blessedly in New York, freelancers, actually, we've come together and we formed our own insurance company. It's an insurance company owned by a nonprofit. This year, we had a zero premium increase and opened a medical practice for freelancers to get free primary care. We are helping to launch three co-ops, one in New York, New Jersey, and Oregon that will be opening in October of this year, so people can get in touch if they live in those three states. And then it's just very difficult. Hopefully with the exchanges, if you earn below 400% of poverty, that means $89,000 for a family of four, you'll be entitled to subsidies and going on the exchange. And, you know, this is the area that I think can be truly and profoundly difficult. But let me just say again, I feel like freelancers so chart out this next era. Freelancers very much take care of themselves, their health, their body. If they don't work, they don't eat. And so people really are looking for a new kind of healthcare that involves yoga and meditation and nutrition, looking at the foods that we eat. It actually has very far-flung implications, not just about the gigs that you're doing today. And again, you know, this is so important.
Let's get to a different issue that's raised very wonderfully by an email that just came in, signed by Fragmented Designer. And here's the question. I've been a freelance designer for 15 years. I have a stable of clients. And while I enjoy this choice, my constant dilemma is feeling fragmented, like there's always more to do than I can accomplish. There's billing, there's marketing, nagging me, various deadlines, various random client requests. How can I achieve more peace and satisfaction and a better sense of control? Fragmented Designer.
Yeah, love Fragmented Designer. I mean, I think that this is about multitasking and to start really setting some clear priorities because it can come all at you, you know, at once. And again, I think what it really starts is you start really, you know, take a deep breath and start with the basics. You know, what's your budget? What do you need to do? What are the things that are paying you that you don't have to worry about and they're going to pay your bills? What are the things that you love to do? You know, there's a saying that says the definition of a strategy is the ability to say no. And freelancers need to develop strategies to figure out when and how they can say no to different things.
You suggest a number of things that I thought were useful about also how you divide up your work, that you spend your day, some of it on your current clients, some of it on prospecting for future clients, some of it sort of cleaning up those administrative details that our Fragmented Designer was saying drove her nuts, sort of organizing your day so that you feel like you're staying on top of it rather than feeling constantly behind.
Yes. You know, it's so important to, you know, take that as a model and then you iterate for yourself. But I would say one of the things that really struck me was to think about your work as like a stock portfolio and thinking about What are your blue chips? What are your growth investments? What are your one shots and long shots? What are your potential new ventures? And again, to the feeling of being fragmented, it lets you start to say, I need this many blue chips that are tried and true. I must have one new venture because I'm worried my field, I see the writing on the wall. And it lets you start putting some control back into your life because you have these tools that let you plan.
Toby in San Francisco also wants to talk about the issue of balance. Toby, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I am a self-employed music teacher. Excuse me. I teach private violin and voice lessons in San Francisco and Palo Alto. And what I've found is that it's really important for me to actually create a weekend, you know, even though it's I could work 7 days a week, and I have students wanting lessons, especially on the actual weekends on Saturday and Sunday. It's been important for me and my wife to say, okay, even if I have students who want lessons on Sundays, and people are knocking on my door, echoing back what you guys were saying about knowing how to say no, I have to say, I'm sorry, that's my day off. And, you know, it seems, at first it seemed arbitrary, but it's been, you know, for me to say this is my day off because I'm working for myself, but it's been really important for me to create some boundaries around when I do work, when I teach, when I email my students and call them, and when I actually turn off the phone or the computer and don't accept lessons and say, this is my day for myself. And it's been important for me, for my mental health.
Yeah, it's such a great point, Toby. Thank you for raising it. Sarah?
Yeah, I think that's great. And it also really speaks well to Toby's business that, you know, in the beginning, if you're desperate, you're working Saturdays and Sundays and happy to be doing it. And it's great to get it to a point where you can actually set those boundaries. And I think that's a goal that people really want to get to.
It's a challenge, though, because if you're a freelancer, you're always worried that you're not going to get that next call or that next client and that you're perpetually working at home or on the weekend because you're just afraid that that next client or that next music student or whoever is not going to come. So how do you deal with that angst?
You know, it's funny, like that's so the theme of this is it's, I think it really leads to something really profound, which is we are living in this, you know, uber consumerist society. And when you work and you have a steady paycheck, it's just this regularity that lets you just spend and spend and spend. And one of the things that freelancers really quickly realize is I can't spend if I don't have this money. So people's spending patterns really change. And that gives people security. You know, when you look at companies, new companies like Airbnb and Etsy and others, it's for people who are saying, I am going to look for other kinds of income to blunt that moment of, oh my God, nothing else is coming in. And I think that's a real societal change. And I think that's really important to recognize because freelancers often feel like I'm the only one doing this. I am alone in my house and I'm the only one. No, this has not happened to anyone. No, no. That's why I wrote the Freelancer's Bible. I hope that people see that this is what's happening to you is happening to many people and these are have been their strategies.
Toby, thanks for the call. It occurs to me also, Sarah, that one of the things you suggest is, in effect, to kind of create your own HR policy so that you give yourself vacations and give yourself permission to take vacations, which is very hard to do when you're a freelancer because there's no such thing as a paid vacation. But to say, the boss, meaning yourself, tells me I got to go do this.
Yes, for sure. You know, turn off. There are just too many emails out there, and it's not about productivity. It's like about addiction in some ways, you know, for all of us. And freelancers have that ability. Freelancers have the ability to say, it matters more to me to be home when my kids come home from school than anything else. I will start work at this amount of time and end at this time, but I, from this time to this time, will be there. Or I need to bike around the park, or I need to do X, Y, or Z. But you have to plan for it, and you really have to stick to it once you've said it.
Does that mean also, Sarah, that you have to begin to look at time differently? In other words, that you give yourself permission to go pick up your kids at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or to go for a bike ride at 2 in the afternoon, realizing that it also may mean that you're going to work at 8 o'clock that night or on Saturday morning for an hour, that you just look at it in a new way.
I think for sure. And I think that that hits people right in the face when, let's say, they've spent a whole career working in a traditional way. They get laid off and then suddenly it's like, wait a minute, what? How? What is time? But I think it's also really interesting to think that the 40-hour work week, like that did not come from Moses or God, you know? That was a creation of humans, and we said that's a week, and it goes from Monday to Friday. And I think freelancers are saying, you know what, I'd work well in the evening, I work well in the morning. You have to figure it out. But in the end, again, you got to get the work done, so you do what you got to do.
Anne in San Jose has our next observation. Anne, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Hey, I just wanted to comment on what you said earlier about the challenges of working as a freelancer in the international market, especially when you look at some of these mega websites now like Odesk. I'm an editor and copy editor, and I find myself in sort of a catch-22 because in one sense, I have an advantage in the market as an editor and copy editor because I need to maintain top U.S. standards for my clients. So I can't just outsource something to India or Bangladesh for copy editing because they're not going to have the English skills, or if it's British, not American, this kind of thing. So in that sense, I console myself that I have a product in my local market that is stronger than what some of these other people are trying to offer and bid for. On the flip side, I feel a little guilty because I do use international freelancers because I kind of can't afford not to for things like helping me build my website, sorry, website designers, you know, things like that that I'm not skilled at, but I can't afford to pay someone $50 an hour to do. And I just wanted to see what your guest's feedback was on that.
And thanks. Sarah?
You know, I think that's a really great way to lay this out here. And, you know, not to sound ridiculous, but you know, we're all human beings, wherever we live, all over the world. And what is terrible is that there's a race to the bottom all over the place right now. And I think it's giving rise to a view that we really want to start looking at local economies and ways that we can be working with people closer to one another, while at the same time recognizing there's this thing called the economy and economies and different kinds of wages. And I think that it is why I truly believe freelancers are the avant-garde of this next economy, because I think we're going to go back and start looking at interesting models like the cooperatives and mutual aid societies, because we're realizing this can, if we're not careful, it will be a race to the bottom in certain fields. And so that's why we're at a moment of great change. I do think, though, for the person, you know, right now, today, what am I supposed to do? Again, I think that you have to start looking at your portfolio and how you're going to justify why you need to earn more. And you can do that. And you're also going to look at your budget to know what you can do. So I think we can see there's some complexity, but it's not scary complexity, just a few things you need to do. And that gives you some guidance about how you're going to answer some of these questions.
And thanks for adding your voice into our program this morning. A couple of others I'm going to read to you. Lori writes in, I'm an independent consultant in San Francisco, and I've been doing this for 5 years. It's been suggested that I should incorporate rather than continue working as a sole proprietor. Do you have any advice, Sarah, on why freelancers should consider LLCs, incorporations, and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very big topic in the Freelancer's Bible because there's not a simple answer. You really have to look at the tax implications, the reason for why you need to, the cost of incorporating. So that one, they're just a little bit of no good one definitional reason for why you should. Some people set up and incorporate so that they can make themselves a W-2 because it helps them purchase their health insurance or get other kinds of tax deductions that they need.
And I should add, listeners, we're not going to be able to cover all of the ground that's covered in Sarah's book, but in the Freelancer's Bible, there's a lot of information about those kinds of questions, as well as tax issues and a variety of other things that are very specific, healthcare, that you know really are useful in terms of sorting out what's necessary for your particular situation. Sam writes in, I'm a freelance photographer, and to get out of my office and digital darkroom, I took a part-time job at a local coffee house. I only work early mornings, 4 hours, 3-4 days a week. I get in a great interaction with a variety of people. And then I'm off at 9 o'clock and I have the better part of the day to work on my photography work. Is that something also you're discovering, Sarah, that a lot of people sort of do one thing on the side to kind of pay the light bill, allowing them time to pursue their passion?
Yes, 100%. Sam, thank you so much for that. And I think what I love about Sam's example is, you know, I think we're used to saying, oh, my God, I have to work and do this other thing. Woe is me. Kind of, boy, that sucks, you know, blah, blah, blah. But actually what you find is it can be really great to be doing something slightly different for a certain part of your day. And I don't mean to sound in any way Pollyanna, because in some ways this can be terrible for some people. But I think it's refreshing for certain professionals to know, you mean I can go and I can do something completely different for a set period of time in my day, and that's my set thing. I can volunteer, I can work in a hospital, or I can volunteer in a homeless shelter. And yeah, you can. And if it can work, great.
Mona T. Brook joins us. She's a freelance photographer who in a prior life was working in corporate marketing. And I'm curious, Mona, if you would give us some sense of how your prior life working in marketing at the corporate level was useful in what seems like a completely different enterprise of photography.
Yes. Hi, Sarah. When I was in tech and I moved over to photography, I had gone back to school at the Academy of Art University, and a lot of my classmates were about 10 years younger than me. And when I used my marketing and my business skills from my previous corporate life into my advantage so that I can start, I knew that I needed to start networking, and I started giving out cards, start doing work, and trying to get as much work as I can so that I can put my name out there. And with 9 years experience now, all of my marketing is all word of mouth. So it's really paid off in that sense.
And Mona, what do artists in particular not necessarily understand about marketing? Is there a particular tip that you could pass on to those who work in the arts?
Yeah, another caller earlier had talked about, you know, you have to really do all the marketing, you have to do all the work at the beginning. And photography is the same way. It's 95% trying to get the work, and then, you know, a fraction of a second just to take the photo. So I think the deal is just to network, just like what Sarah said, just to make yourself out there, be visible, be able to see what people needs are, and use social media to figure out, you know, well, I see somebody getting married, so I'm going to approach them and say if they need a photographer. So there's different ways to market yourself.
Sarah, it's one aspect also of marketing that I think is sometimes forgotten, and you write about this some in the book, that don't have 10 different pitches that you're putting out there. Think about one. I mean, really be more specific. Sometimes we all have a tendency to want to cover the bases, but that's not always mm-hmm. the best approach, right?
Right. I mean, I think you just want to be clear of what's the value proposition. What are you trying to get at? What do you want to communicate, both in terms of when you're networking to say, if you know anyone who has these needs, I'm your person. And but again, trying to be simple and clear about what it is.
Mona, thanks so much for adding your point of view. Chris writes in from Fairfax, I've had a freelance art business, and yesterday I came up with the 4 main paths to success. 1, maintain and continually improve your skill set. 2, network with peers and potential clients. 3, find your niche. Find a specialization that fills a need. 4, shake hands with the hidden business self within you. That's good. I like that, Chris. Karen writes in, how do freelancers get medical insurance? What are the benefits of joining the freelance Union? We've described that some, but that is such a big question for so many freelancers. Sarah, you want to recap that again, please?
About health insurance in
yeah.
particular? Okay. Well, one thing also, I'll just grab that. Freelancers Union, you can just join, and the benefits are that we actually have benefits and come together and talk to other people. Health insurance, you know, the health exchanges are going to start kicking in next year. So starting in October, pay attention to your state, and Freelancers Union will, of course, be having resources available for you to know that. And then looking at professional associations, chambers of commerce, other things. Again, thinking about incorporating. There's a whole piece in the book on benefits. So if that's your thing, you know, take a look at that to see if there's something in there that's specifically helpful.
Let's squeeze in one more call. Kamal joins us in Oakland. Just a brief recommendation from you, Kamal.
Another call that I called in about, like, having an anxiety and having, you know, dry spells and stuff. And I think that really ties into charging more, a couple of things, because you have to charge what you're worth. Because right now I have an accountant that I meet with remotely. She logs into my computer, does all my QuickBooks stuff. $60 a month is, like, invaluable to me, saves me hours of work. I have a CPA to do my taxes at the end of the year, saves me hours of work. And I end up, you know, he cost me $500, but I've paid way more than $500 in, like, late fees because I never did my taxes on time, you know?
No, those are great points. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and also fire your clients. You know, your clients, you work for them, but they, you know, they're also your clients. If you're juggling a lot of balls, like, I used to have about 10 clients. Right now I have about 3. And I make the same amount of money. I do better and more quality work for these 3 clients who I love than I was doing trying to juggle all these hats with 10. You have to fire the ones that are bad. And I give.
And Kamal, I'm going to have to hold you there, but thanks for providing that advice. As a last takeoff point, Sarah Horowitz, can you comment on that about sort of knowing how you really want to focus your business?
Yeah, I mean, I think one great point is you want Kamal in your network because you want to find out who that great remote accountant is for freelancers. And that's why you need a network, because you can't know everything. And I think to his point, look, you have to decide what kind of life you want to lead. And freelancing lets you start making trade-offs and starting to look at it. You just need to go back to the basics, get a few things straight, and then you move from there and you figure it out.
Sarah Horowitz, the author of The Freelancer's Bible, founder of Freelancers Union. Sarah, I think we could do this as a weekly show. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you. Take care.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer, Paul Ancour. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.